Welcome to the second hour of Be the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
You can always find us at wethepeopleradio.us. There you go.
There you have it.
.net, .biz, .a lot of things, just not .com. Somebody has it, and they want me to pay them a lot of money for it, and I'm just not doing it.
Yeah, we don't need it.
Nah, I'm just not doing it.
They're small potatoes.
So we go with .us, what the heck.
Yeah.
But I tell you, got archives going back like 15 years. I can't tell you how many times I'm talking to somebody who says, well, have you ever heard of... And I'm like, well, as a matter of fact, I interviewed them.
We talked about that when I had hair.
I didn't even know you when you had hair.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay, I lied.
Ouch. I'm calling your mom. We've done all sorts of stuff. And just in case you're thinking we're doing, you know, dopey local. Okay, not to say that local is dopey, but if you're thinking it's just, you know, a bunch of stuff nobody cares about. Well, just to let you know how in the know we are, we did a show with Robert Tannenbaum. We did a couple, actually, but at the end of April, April 27th, he was part of the review for the Warren Commission and some of that stuff on the Kennedy assassination. And imagine my surprise, we interviewed him on a Sunday, and Friday he was on Coast to Coast Radio. There you go. So, Phil Kirpin, our guest this hour, you just wait for your invite.
Yeah, George Norrie's going to be calling
the big
time. I'm sure.
We're apparently the conduit to the big time.
You know anything about flying saucers?
Yeah, okay, ancient astronaut theorist. He piped down over there.
Okay, I'm sorry.
All right, so Phil Kirpin, he's been on with us before, and it's going to be really fun. So this will be the end of Bill and I, and then Phil will just, like, talk to us for a whole hour. He is a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington, D.C. He was the principal policy and legislative strategist at Americans for Prosperity for over 5 years. He previously worked at the Free Enterprise Fund, Club for Growth, and the Cato Institute. He's also a nationally syndicated columnist, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition, and the author of the 2011 book, Democracy Denied. He's the president of American Commitment, that is dedicated to restoring and protecting the American commitment to free markets, economic growth, constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom. They engage in critical public policy fights over the size and intrusiveness of government. Imagine that.
Plenty of that to go around.
Yeah, lots of that. Through direct advocacy, strategic policy and analysis, and grassroots mobilization, he works with key partners. And American Commitment delivers timely, effective public policy research to the broader free market movement dedicated to restoring and protecting free markets, economic growth, constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom. Yeah. And I tried to say it as fast as Phil would say it.
Yeah.
Because he talks actually faster than I do. But I have linked up previous shows with him. We've talked about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and all sorts of interesting things. So today is about the big, beautiful bill that you keep hearing about. And David was in there waving something to me while I was trying to read something and talk really fast. So he's telling me, give us a second because they're having trouble connecting. Okay. So
yeah, I had a feeling he wasn't there because otherwise you would have heard raucous laughter after that.
he missed all my fun. He'll have to listen to the archive.
Yeah.
And by the way, our archives, just to not skip that over, a lot of archives on radio programs and things, it costs money to listen. It's you have to be a subscriber. You have to give your email. You have to do all this stuff. Ours. Go to wethepeopleradio.us. You click on the button to listen. It's an MP3 file. You can put it on your phone. You can listen to it on your computer. You can burn it to a CD and sell it to your friends. I don't care.
Well, it's all broken out by categories, too. So if you have something in particular you want information on, it's real easy to find.
It is easy to find, and we've had a lot of really interesting people. So we hope you make use of that because we try to do things that are not, you know, not specific to one small area and are not things that are going away anytime soon. Yeah, so let's see. Oh, I have attached his article, Phil Kirpin's article from April 30th. Oh, I hear sounds of life on the other side. Phil, we've been goofing off. And I tried to read your bio. I tried to read your bio as fast as you would read your bio, so you missed that part. But I just want you to know. I just want you to know I did my very best.
Very good. Very good. How are we doing today?
Oh, you know what? Well, obviously, you know, we're reading your bio at high speed, so.
What could be more fun than that? Wow.
Well, exactly, because, you know, you too could say, you know, economic growth, constitution, limited government, property rights, and individual freedom.
Whoa. That is faster than I read.
Isn't that great?
Very nice.
I've been practicing while you were trapped in...
Don't mishear me.
In we can't connect you on the phone land. Oh, my God.
Wow.
So all we keep hearing about is the big, beautiful bill. But I do believe that there are pieces of this, like the RAINS Act, that is absolutely not being discussed. And so I was really excited when I saw your article about that, because I thought, good, I want people to know about that because I think they would like it.
Yeah, this is kind of an amazing one. You know, we'll see if it survives. I don't want everyone too excited because I don't know if what's in the bill will stay in the bill. But, you know, while all of the focus has been on the Ways and Means Committee and the Energy and Commerce Committee, they respectively have all the tax changes and all the Medicaid changes.
Well, so don't forget all the big lies about how we're getting rid of Social Security and Medicare, right? So a lot of focus on things that are fictional.
Which, by the way, you know, Social Security by law cannot be changed in a reconciliation bill.
Right.
So I don't even know what these people are talking about. You know,
they don't either.
It's insane. They just don't care whether what they say is true or not. But the House Judiciary Committee,
yes,
with very little fanfare, actually put one of the most important provisions ever, if it were able to pass, in their title, their section, the Big Beautiful Bill. And it's a bill we've talked about in your show before called the RAINS Act. And this would sort of reverse the process for the way that Congress reviews regulations. The way it works now, agencies more or less do whatever they want unless somehow, once in every great while, you get a majority in the House and a majority in the Senate to overturn a regulation. And even then, unless there's been a recent presidential election, you just get a veto by the same president whose bureaucrats promulgated the regulation in the first place, and that's the end of that. So the way it works now, Congress only ever overturns the regulation when they affirmatively muster a majority in the House and Senate to overturn it after the fact, and when there's just been a presidential election, so the new guy can sign the overturn. Other than that, agencies pretty much get free rein, at least from Congress. Sometimes the courts step in and stop them, but that's, of course, always a roll of the dice. Under this bill, which, as I said, has been included in the Judiciary Committee title of the Big Beautiful Bill, under this bill, the major regulations, the significant ones, the ones that have a major economic impact and major impact on the federal budget, the agencies would no longer be able to implement them directly. Instead, they would have to send them as a proposal to Congress, and they would have to get affirmative approval by a majority in both the House and the Senate first before they could take effect. And I believe if we had this process in place, even when we have Democrats in the House, Senate, and White House, we would be able to stop the worst of the worst. For instance, remember when Obama was president, they tried to do the big cap-and-trade climate bill, which, of course, you have a state version of in California, but they tried to do nationally. They couldn't, even with pretty sizable Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate. They fell short. I think they passed it by 8 votes in the House, and then they never even had the vote in the Senate because all the Democratic senators were running for the hills. But
Right. Then
the EPA pretty much implemented half the things that were in that bill on their own. They just did them by regulation. Well, if we had this process in place, all of those EPA rules would have had to be sent up for approval, and we probably would have been able to stop almost all of them. And, of course, you know, if you can't stop a regulation under this process, you would at least be able to look up who voted for it and hold them accountable come election time without it all just riding on the presidential and having these wild pendulum swings back and forth every 4 or 8 years with the party in the White House. So this is a huge idea. If we got this in, it would probably be worth about $1 trillion in deficit reduction because we'd have a faster growing economy and we'd have, you know, less demand on government programs if we had a more stable, more business-friendly regulatory environment. That was a Heritage Foundation estimate. And it is in the House bill. Now, I have heard conflicting opinions as to whether Senate rules will allow this to stay in the Senate. Senator Mike Lee says absolutely it can stay in. I have heard from several other experts that this would be fatal to the bill and needs to be removed immediately in the Senate. So I don't know.
Senate rules don't make any sense to me.
I don't know who's right about that. But
for the moment
at least, this very important reform is in the House version.
Okay. Well, is it the Byrd rule? I mean, is that what's doing it?
Yeah, this would be a Byrd Rule challenge, I believe. But, you know, the way they wrote it to try to survive this, they, instead of just saying regulations that are economically significant would go through this process of requiring approval, what they said is rules that have a substantial impact on the federal budget would have to go up for approval. And, you know, that actually in practice ends up being just about the same thing, because the rules that make a big impact on the economy also necessarily make a big impact on the budget. But by phrasing it this way, they think that it may survive the Senate rules, although, as I said, there is a difference of opinion on that point, so it remains to be seen.
Well, so why give people some examples of why they care about this?
Well, you know, the single most costly regulation in the history of the country is the Biden administration's ban on internal combustion vehicles. And, of course, your listeners might not care too much about that because California already has its own ban, whether we have a national ban or not. But even the California ban, that needed to get federal approval. And so if we had this process in place, a lot of these really destructive, expensive regulations, like the one that says you can't buy an internal combustion vehicle, if that's the kind of car or truck you prefer, I'm not saying that could never happen. But in order for it to happen, they'd have to get a majority in the House and Senate. And I think that would be very, very hard for something like that, even when they have Democrats in. And so it makes a big impact on some of these things that affect your life directly, including, you know, a lot of the water regulations and energy regulations, things that Trump has talked about a lot. There's a real question whether those things ever could have gotten through if there had to be a vote in the House and Senate and actual majorities in favor of it. And, of course, you know, that's just kind of the energy and environment area. There are all kinds of things that make financial services more expensive and inaccessible, that make, you know, labor policy, that make it more difficult to do business, all kinds of different rules and regulations from the vast federal leviathan. And in the hope would be, if the agencies need to send it up to Congress and get a majority, they're going to do a much better job writing a rule because they know that they're going to need to command majority support. So it's really going to need to be much better developed and better defended and much more solid on the merits. And so I think we would see the cost of federal regulation go down a lot. And just so that people understand kind of the scale of what we're talking about, new regulations in the 4 years of the Biden administration imposed a cost in net present value terms of about $47,000 per household. So net present value, that means that in order for you to pay off the costs of what Biden's new regulations would cost you over the rest of your life, you would have to stick $47,000 in a special savings account just to cover regulatory compliance costs. And that's just the new costs that we had in the 4 years of Joe Biden. Now, Trump's going to reverse a lot of that, and he already has since reversed that electric vehicle mandate. But you know, there are a lot of costs associated with these things just being turned on and off. And also, it's a terrible thing for the economy to have kind of everything ride from a regulatory standpoint on the presidential election. We would have a lot more stability if these things went through Congress.
Yeah, because, and you're right. So when you say, like, you know, we make these wild swings, maybe because I think people feel it, but they don't really know why that's happening. Maybe you could kind of spell that out a little bit, why this is a bad thing and what it looks like on the ground. That we did, and we just didn't have it in the past. I mean, it's kind of a new phenomenon.
The waiver that lets California set its own fuel economy standards and therefore ban internal combustion vehicles, that was issued for the first time under the Obama administration, right? And Trump came in and he got rid of it. And Biden came in and he put it back on, and now Trump's going to get rid of it again. So, you know, if you're an auto dealer or an automaker, you know, how do you make sense of what your next 5 or 10 years look like from a planning standpoint, from an investment standpoint, if every time the party in the White House changes, the whole business changes? And, you know, that's just the most obvious example, but there's so many other examples across all the different policy areas, healthcare, energy, tech policy, everything. We just have such wildly different regulatory approaches right now between the two political parties. The Democrats are so aggressive and heavy-handed and impose so much cost and so much constraint on all of these business areas, and you get a Republican and it could take a whole 4-year term just to reverse the things the Democrats did, let alone try to do new things and do other deregulations and so forth. And so it's really, really tough on businesses from a planning standpoint, and there's a serious negative impact on economic growth and on wage growth as a consequence of that ping-ponging back and forth. And, of course, if you think like I do that most of these regulations are terrible and they should be gotten rid of, then Republicans aren't doing the wrong thing, spending most of their time just on doing what the last Democratic administration did. But, think how much more productive they could be the Democrats weren't off to the races every time on all these regulations, but instead had a process where they need to actually sell them to Congress and get them approved and, do many fewer, but they would have to be much better or else they wouldn't be able to get through. So it really would be a total change in process that I think would be really, really positive, not just from the perspective of, people like me who like, a smaller government and less regulation, but, just if you like regulation, just the quality of them is going to be much, much better, I think, if they have to be able to command majority support in the Congress.
Yeah, I think so too. It's a lot less because the regulation when it is coming at people like that, they don't even know. It isn't like, there's supposed to be a little bit of fanfare, but there isn't. Suddenly, all of a sudden, you find yourself kind of captured. It's like, how did this happen? When did we pass all these laws? And I think that's where the confusion lies. We write these kind of...
Yeah, people kind of see the federal regulations in their own industry, right? Especially if you're in a heavily regulated industry, you kind of get that there are a lot of rules and regulations. But all the rules and regulations on businesses that you're not involved in yourself, where you see them in the prices you pay. That's where you see them.
Yes.
You don't really see them any other place. And even then, unless you're thinking about it, you don't know. I mean, look... The price, for instance, of HVAC systems for your home approximately doubled under the Biden administration in those 4 years. The average for a new central air unit and handler went from about $6,000 to about $12,000, okay? Now, unless you need to replace an HVAC unit in your house, you don't even know. You have no idea. But you know what? The next time you have to, your eyes are going to bulge out. Right?
Well, or you go to buy a new home. Like we need our homes to cost more money.
That's a really good point. Especially because of so many of the regulations in the last administration were geared towards home appliances and home systems, that it really does have a material impact on home affordability when all of the appliances are more expensive, when all of the systems are more expensive. Now, Trump is reversing all of those. He's in the process of reversing all of those. But, think about this from the manufacturer's standpoint, right? If you just spent a fortune to comply with new regulations and then the regulations are removed, well, you're not going to unspend all the money that you spent, right? And so you're probably going to keep producing the things you were producing. Now, there might be competitive competitive pressures of somebody who brings, lower cost models back on or that kind of thing. But on the whole, you get more of a ratchet in the direction of things costing more, even when these regulations toggle on and off.
Yeah, it just becomes ridiculous. And most of them don't make your life better. I guess that's the whole thing. And people figure that out right away. Phil, we have to take a really quick
break. If they make it better, then you don't need to require it.
Well,
make that choice. This
because people would like it, right? And then they would do it for themselves, but they're not. So that should be obvious. But then, we have the babysitters. We have the babysitter faction that says, that we're not qualified to make those decisions for ourselves.
You're always good for yourself, yeah.
Yeah. We shouldn't be looking out after ourselves. Us children, we need to have supervision at all times. So part of the supervision is we have to take breaks. And so we will be, David the Fun Killer in there has his finger on the button. So we will be right back. Our guest is Phil Kirpin. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
They drag you by your feet, but the hand.
there you go, Phil. If you ever turn American Commitment into a musical, there's your theme song.
Yeah, good one.
Mm-hmm. Because honestly, at this point, that's kind of the Trump plan, right? We want it all, and we want it now. Because
they're loading it all up into this one bill, so it's a must. It's a must do. It's a must. You know, and we can get into, if you'd like, the tax title and the energy and commerce title that has potentially some Medicaid changes. I'm happy to talk about any of the other aspects or
sure.
Stand regulation, whatever you want.
Yeah, sure. Because there will be changes, but it won't be to people who it won't affect the people who legitimately are in those programs who qualify for them.
Well,
unless it's maybe a work requirement or something.
Well, I'm hoping we are going to have a work requirement. Just so people understand, federal Medicaid spending is up more than 50% in the last 5 years, and it's almost doubled in the state of California, federal Medicaid funding into California, over the Biden years. The budget that Newsom just sent up, the budget revision that Newsom just sent up, expects more than $120 billion of federal Medicaid funding in the next fiscal year. That is more than the entire state budget of the state of Florida, just in federal Medicaid dollars to the state of California. And that's because you put illegal immigrants into Medicaid, you got rid of income and asset rules for nursing homes, so everyone in the state of California can go into nursing homes on federal dollars. You basically opened up the floodgates, and you have to give credit, I guess, to the geniuses in California who figured out how to milk federal taxpayers to the maximum. But essentially, the state doesn't even put up the state share anymore. Instead, the way they contribute the quote-unquote state share is they tax the Medicaid managed care organizations just to release the federal money, and then they give the money back to them. And in fact, they get reimbursed for that and then some, and so they come out ahead, and then the quote-unquote state dollars that were raised can be used for the illegals. And this is what's been going on. And so we're hoping that there are going to be some substantial reforms to tighten all of this up. They were talking about fixing these loopholes, this provider tax loophole, or this now more sophisticated managed care organization tax like California and New York have. That is not in this bill. In fact, what they did is they prohibited states from doing it going forward. So they basically grandfather California and New York, which I find pretty outrageous. But I guess the politics of the members from those states or something like that is why they compromised on that. And we still have this bizarre situation where, for every dollar of state Medicaid spending on a disabled person or a pregnant woman or an elderly person or children, you get $1.33 in federal money, but for every dollar that you spend of state funds on an able-bodied, non-disabled, working-age adult, you get $9 of federal funds because of the way Obamacare was written with the massive... Sorry, what?
I say, what, that just doesn't make sense.
No one can defend it. No one can make it make sense to me. And what I've said is, look, even if you don't want to save money for federal taxpayers by lowering the match rate for the Obamacare expansion population, those able-bodied working-age adults, even if you're totally against just lowering that as savings for the federal taxpayer, at least meet in the middle. You could do it even on a deficit-neutral basis, but at least meet in the middle so we're not creating this huge reward for states if they cover an able-bodied, non-disabled, working-age adult versus an actual needy person who was the reason the program was committed in the first place.
Exactly.
I find it totally indefensible, the disparity. But they have not addressed that in the version of the bill that came out of committee last week. The one thing they did do was work requirements, which say if you're not disabled, if you're able to work, in order to get free health care from Medicaid, you have to either be working or be in a qualified job training program. So they did put that in there. But it doesn't start until 2029. So it's pretty meager. They've done very, very little in terms of Medicaid reform in this bill. And this is one of the holdups right now, while you've got a handful of more conservative House members saying, wait a second, we're not going to vote for this until you strengthen it, led by Chip Roy from Texas. And so that's kind of the holdup at the moment. The other big holdup at the moment is most of the Green New Deal, Inflation Reduction Act giveaways for wind and solar and hydrogen and all of that, and most of those either don't get eliminated at all or get phased out over several years, are kept intact for quite a while. And so, you know, that's another point of contention, because you could save a lot of money for taxpayers if you got rid of those immediately, or if you brought back some of the Medicaid reforms that we were talking about, or at least if the only Medicaid reform we're going to get is the work requirements, you could start it a lot sooner than 2029. And so this is a big stumbling block right now, is that they seem to have accommodated some of the moderate members to such an extent that some of the conservatives now are kind of, throwing their hands up and saying, stop, we need to dial this bill back in the other direction.
Do you have the numbers on how much Medicaid funds were spent on illegals in California?
It's about $10 billion, as I understand it. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. And it's a little tricky, because they will say that all but, you know, I think $1 or $2 billion of it is what's designated emergency, like true emergency, like someone's about to die and then you take them to the emergency room. And that does get federal funding. The rest of it is notionally state funding, but remember, they use that money laundering scale with the managed care organization tax to basically turn federal money into quote-unquote state money and then use that to cover the illegals. And so now you, of course, as both California and federal taxpayers, probably find it equally offensive either way which pot of money it's coming from. But as a federal taxpayer, I find it particularly egregious that they use a money laundering technique to essentially take federal funds to cover illegals, which is supposed to be prohibited by law.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And that is that's always a huge thing. The one thing with this, though, the must pass part of this is really the tax, the continuation of the 2017 tax bill, or everybody's taxes are going up. I mean,
this is the reason they have to get it done, whatever else is included or not included. If they fail to extend the expiring tax provisions, then, you know, when the clock strikes midnight on December 31st, the Trump tax cuts turn into a pumpkin and everybody's taxes go up pretty significantly.
Yes,
the standard deduction gets cut in half. All of the rates go up. The child credit goes from 2,000 to 1,000. And so, you know, obviously it depends how many kids you have and other things, but on average, you're looking at $2,000 to $3,000 per family and higher taxes if that happens. And so I don't think that they can let that happen, but the danger is that they can't get consensus among Republicans, and we start moving towards the end of the year and Republican leadership says, oh, well, I guess we need to cut a deal with the Democrats instead. And I don't even want to know what that bill looks like, but it's not going to be good.
Well, the kicker is they can do another reconciliation. You know, they can do another reconciliation that could involve some other things. The problem is if we get the guys that won't vote for anything that isn't perfect, that's not really the world we live in. And the tax stuff has to get done. For all the people out there that think that all these tax breaks are going, you know, going to the rich, it's like you kind of need to pay attention.
This is the thing that's so crazy about the whole tax cuts for the rich. And first of all, every single person who pays taxes got a tax cut under the Trump tax cuts, with only one exception. And that exception was very high-income people in very high state and local income tax areas. And because of the cap on the state and local tax deduction, some of those people did see a tax increase. But even in a state like New York or a state like California, it's about 8% of households in those very high-tax states had an increase. The vast majority of people, even in those states, got a tax cut. But bizarrely, this is one of the big holdups on the bill right now, is we've got some Republican members from these very high-tax states who want to get rid of the SALT cap. The problem with that is, there's two problems. One is the scoring problem.
State and local tax provision for their household.
For property tax and income tax.
Yeah.
There used to be no limit on how much you could deduct unless you were in the AMT. And so, you know, a lot of people who were not in the AMT, they could deduct a whole bunch. Now, of course, a lot of people think that they were able to deduct a whole bunch because they don't kind of connect the dots, but they were actually paying AMT, and it was taking all of their state and local tax deduction back from them already. And so you've got some people who are angry about this cap who weren't actually hurt by it, but just didn't necessarily connect the dots that under the AMT, which, you know, almost nobody pays anymore post the Trump tax cuts, but a lot of families in high tax states did pay before. Under that, you got no deduction. You got a zero deduction for state and local tax if you were in the AMT. And so it gets a little bit complicated, but the bottom line is the only people who got a tax increase were very wealthy people in very high tax blue states. And you know, the Democrats have always told us they want to tax the rich more, except apparently not their rich. Apparently, when they say tax the rich, they don't mean their rich in blue states, because they hate the salt cap.
Yeah, well, and so I was carrying around the Ways and Means kind of chart here, because it was pretty good. It was actually very tight little deal here. So as a result of the Trump tax cuts, the bottom 20% of earners saw their federal tax rate fall to its lowest level in 40 years. And if you look at this thing, the bottom 50% of taxpayers pay 2.3% of the total income taxes. That's a lot of people not paying a whole lot. The top 10% pay 75.8%. Their rate went up. It went from 70 to 75. And the top 1%.
And by the way, that's with most of them getting a tax cut. But what often happens with a tax cut is you produce more, you have higher income,
right,
and with a lower percentage, you're paying more in tax in dollar terms. And by the way, we saw that very much on the corporate side, where the rate was cut from 35 to 21. Now, that one does not expire. That one was made permanent. But, you know, revenues went up dramatically from the corporate tax when we cut that rate. And one of the things I am worried about in this process is that at some point you might see an amendment that, say, you know, supersizes the child credit and raises the corporate rate or something like that. And I hope we'll be able to beat back an amendment that tries to do that, because the lower corporate rate has been a massive success, not just in making us much more competitive internationally, but also in raising revenue. We've raised more money. The federal government has raised a lot more money at a lower corporate rate than they did at a higher rate. And so when you look at these tax shares, by the way, the top 1% of income earners paid an all-time record percentage of total income taxes in 2022. They paid 45% of all the income taxes in 2022. Now, it was down a little in 2023, but it was still over 40%. And so this regime with lower rates, including a 37% rate at the top and 20% exclusion for small business income, we're raising more money than ever from people at the top using these reduced rates. And so, you know, this class warfare stuff from the Democrats, it really doesn't make much sense in terms of the way these policies have actually succeeded.
Well, it doesn't pencil with actual IRS information, because then my last one here, in 2017, the top 1% were paying 38.5%. In 2021, they're paying 45.8%. So the top 1%.
Yeah, I think it went down a little bit in the most recent year,
it's still above 38.
Yeah.
So this idea that these people, like, these guys got like a free ride is just, well, it's just not factual.
Correct. And the other thing I think is very important, if we're talking about the danger of this whole thing expiring, is when they cut the rate for corporate businesses from 35 to 21, one of the things that a lot of members, particularly Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, was concerned about is, look, what about all the non-corporate businesses? What about all the family businesses, all of the partnerships, all the proprietorships, all the businesses that do not use a corporate form? We've got to do better for them than just cutting the top rate from 39.6 to 37, especially because the tax for their corporate competitors is going down so much. And they came up with this idea called 199 capital A. And basically what that does is it excludes 20% of non-corporate business income on individual returns. And there's some guardrails, so like big law firms and consulting firms, they can't really take advantage of this. But the idea is that for manufacturing businesses, for a lot of businesses that use partnerships and other non-corporate forms, we wanted them to have a substantial tax cut and a lower tax rate so that they could be more competitive. And so not only was the rate cut from 39.6 to 37, but they also got to exclude 20% of their income. And so the rate on small business income went from about 40% to about 29%, 29 point something, when you have that exclusion. And the Big Beautiful Bill actually not only extends it, but it increases the small business exclusion from 20% to 23%. And so the effective rate goes from 29 and change to about 28. And so there's a significant tax cut in this bill for small businesses, for non-corporate businesses, which will make them more competitive, make it easier for them to invest and expand their businesses, to give people raises and so forth. I think that's a really important aspect of this, both in terms of the positive of what they're trying to do, but also the negative and the danger of this falls apart and the automatic tax hike happens January 1st for businesses that are non-corporate businesses and pay on an individual return, we're talking about a much bigger tax hike than we are for regular individual ratepayers, because we're talking about them going from 29% and change to 40%. And so we've got to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, we do. And so we have to take a quick break. So anybody who tells you from this point forward that they're cutting benefits to seniors, veterans, all that stuff with Social Security, that is a lie. It is not in the bill. The big, beautiful bill does not cut Social Security. It also doesn't cut Medicare to seniors, and it doesn't cut veterans' benefits. So I don't know what else we can say other than those are not true, and we have a song about it. So we're going to play it right now. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at We the People Radio.
Yes.
So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you played before. California's a brand new game.
Yes, and we make up our own rules here.
That's right. If you don't like him,
then we'll just make up some more.
You pay more.
Oh, no, you get that anyway. That's just that's a feature, not a bug.
Oh.
Yeah. All right, Phil. What have we missed? What have we not included in this sparky little discussion here?
Well, you know, I think we covered the tax piece, which is the biggest piece. The one aspect of it we didn't talk about that much are the Inflation Reduction Act green giveaways.
Yes.
This is, you know, they originally said it was going to be $300 billion. Now the score is over $1 trillion.
Wow.
In giveaways for wind and solar subsidies and electric vehicles and all of the, you know, hydrogen, all of the other favored non-fossil fuel energy sources. And every single Republican in Congress voted against this bill, the Inflation Reduction Act. By the way, the worst, most backwardly misnamed bill since the Affordable Care Act, the Inflation
yeah.
Reduction Act, which we all remember how much it reduced inflation. But they had this, you know, they had about $1 trillion in giveaways, and the Republicans, shockingly, are mostly failing to repeal them. They've got a bunch of them that they repeal starting in 2028 and 29, and they've got some with a multi-year phase down, and they've got some that they keep completely. And so this is another one of these classic examples of the Democrats come in, spend some ungodly amount of money on a variety of new programs, and Republicans say, oh, I don't know if we can get rid of it. Such and such business in my district gets that money, and so maybe let's start a phase out that'll never succeed. I mean, you think about some of these things. The wind production tax credit started in 1992, and it was going to be just 5 years. And every time it gets extended, they say, oh, this is the last time. We just say, well, we'll be able to stand on our own without this. We just have one more extension. But these things never end. They never end. It's unbelievable. And so I think that, you know, that aspect of this bill could be much, much stronger. And if they could bring that in, they could also do, you know, one of the big things that's missing in this bill that they could easily pay for if they accelerated the green credits or accelerated the Medicaid work requirements or any other things we're talking about. They could do the president's 15% corporate rate, which he campaigned on over and over and over. That's nowhere to be found in this bill. I thought I was, you know, when I flipped through it, I was like, well, where's that 15% rate? You remember we talked about how successful going from 35 to 21 was and how we became kind of of the most attractive destination in the world for multinational corporations, and they relocated tons of activity here, and revenues actually went up, not down. Well, the rest of the world hasn't been standing still. They responded to our cut by cutting, and we're again, believe it or not, when you add in state and local corporate tax on top of the federal, we're not at 21, we're at about 26, and that's actually above average in the OECD countries. And so to really be competitive, we should be cutting that again, and we could easily pay to cut that again if they would just fix some of these shortcomings in the bill. And so, and that's the, those are the big changes that, that I've been urging for. And, you know, we'll see. As I said, it's all sort of up in the air right now. They haven't even cleared the House yet. And then, of course, you know, the Senate might have totally different ideas. So the one thing I can say confidently is they're not going to make the president's deadline of getting this on his desk by Memorial Day, because we've only got a week left.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. And with so, you know, the more, you know how it is, like the more you mess with stuff, sometimes the worse it gets. So at this point, they, and I think the other part that's confusing that we didn't really, that we really didn't touch on, you know, also involves rules of just how you pass stuff, but the 4.5 trillion.
I got to be honest, I don't understand Senate rules. So
yeah, the rules are kind of weird, but the 4.5 trillion in quote tax cuts. The thing that I think is never made clear there are many things in media that are not made clear, but one of the things that's really important I think for people to grasp is that 4.5 trillion is currently not going into the Treasury. It was what they considered to be the tax cut in 2017. The problem is, in order to reauthorize it, we have to now pretend like we are cutting 4.5 trillion, because if we don't reauthorize the tax bill from 2017, that money would come into the Treasury. Therefore, you have to treat it like it is being currently cut. And that's why other things have to be subtracted in order for it to continue forward. It's a procedural thing, but it's important.
You really want to get your mind blown. I'll try to explain this the best I can. The House is doing exactly what you said. They're using what's called the current law baseline, which is to say the scores that they're using assume that all of the Trump tax cuts expire on January 1st, and therefore extending exactly the tax code the way we have it now costs, you know, $4 trillion plus dollars. And that's kind of how they're doing it in the House side. The Senate did not do that. For the Senate scoring purposes, they said, we're going to use what's called the current policy baseline. So assume that extending everything the way we have it right now is zero. And then they created an additional instruction to do more tax cuts on top of that for another $2 trillion. And so the Senate actually has a much bigger, in practice, tax instruction, even though it looks smaller because it says $2 trillion and the House one says $4.5 trillion. It's actually bigger because they used a different baseline. They used the current policy baseline. The Senate also, this is the other thing that's so crazy about the way, you normally, when a budget passes both the House and Senate, you think that means that they agreed, right? If for it to pass, you would think, oh, they've agreed on how much to cut spending, how much to cut taxes. There's no agreement at all in this, because not only did they use different numbers and different scoring methods for the tax part of the bill, but they used totally different numbers for the spending parts of the bill, for the committees that are doing the spending reductions. The House has spending reduction instructions to their committees that total $1.5 trillion, trillion with a T. Now, that's over 10 years, so it's almost nothing, because it's over 10 years where they're going to have, you know, 80 or 90 trillion in spending. And so it's like a less than 2% decrease in spending, but it's something. The Senate committee instructions, they've got 4 billion with a B, which is basically zero in the federal budget.
Yeah, really.
You know, when you're talking about 4 billion in spending cuts over 10 years is essentially zero. And so the Senate instructions on spending have basically no spending cuts at all. Actually have net spending increases, because they've got increases for things like border and defense, and the committees that do have decreases, it's nothing. It's four committees that have $1 billion in decreases each. And so we've got this really weird situation where the House is doing this enormous amount of work to meet the instructions of the budget resolution, and the Senate has totally different instructions. And the Senate might ignore the House bill and just do their own thing, or, you know, the difficult decisions have sort of been postponed. Instead of being resolved in the budget, they sort of postponed them by putting different instructions for the House and for the Senate. And so I'm hoping that we'll see this clear the House very shortly. They're pretty close. They probably need a couple of deals here to get it past the line. But clearing the House in this instance means a lot less than it usually does because of how big the differences are between the House and Senate right now.
Yeah. Well, the good part is if they can get this through, solidify the tax cuts, then we've taken sort of Damocles off of everybody in taxpayer land, and then we can go after a bunch of other stuff. But
well, the sooner they can get it done, the better. The sooner they can get it done, the better. Look, I mean, one of the big problems with the Trump tax bill in 2017 is they didn't get it done until, you know, the last week of December.
Right.
With the threat of missing Christmas, what finally got Congress to get their act together and get it finished. We cannot afford for that to happen this year because it gets us way too close to that massive multi-trillion-dollar tax hike coming at the end of the year. And, you know, if they don't get this cleared and resolved sooner in the year rather than later, there's going to be a huge amount of economic activity that just moves to the sidelines while companies and individuals are sort of saying, wait a second, let me see what my taxes are going to be next year before I make a decision on this. And that will be very damaging to the economy. And of course, that economic damage and delaying the upside of the new tax cuts as well, that would be very bad for Republicans politically because it means that whatever the benefits are not going to be felt before the election next year. And so they really need to figure out how to get on the same page and get this done sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And at some point, you know, it when you have slim majorities in both the House and the Senate, reconciliation is a great tool, but we can't afford to hang ourselves on perfection and then fumble the ball. I kind of look at that. I'm like, okay.
Well, that's always been the big problem. Is you have certain members that just want a perfect bill, and it holds the whole thing up. It's not going to be perfect. Hopefully, it'll be.
It's going to be big and beautiful, but perfect isn't in the name, right?
No, that's right.
The OBBB, the one big beautiful bill, or as I like to call it, the OBaby.
Well, that's the thing, and then we can move to. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff going on, but we need out here. We need a. The guy that's the appointee for Fish and Wildlife, we need that guy in the chair so we can get so we can deal with the wolves out here. So there are things that don't potentially affect the rest of the country, but it's stuff that regular people in regular America do need to have done. So,
oh, absolutely. The Senate still has a lot of nominees they need to clear, including my friend Casey Mulligan, who's going to be kind of the regulatory czar at the Small Business Administration. He's been waiting for his confirmation, and that's, you know, I need him confirmed in his new job because I use his numbers all the time. So it's like, I mean, you know, if he's leaving the University of Chicago for the Trump administration, they got to get that done.
Yeah.
So he can start publishing again.
Well, that's the thing. There's a lot of other stuff that exists outside of the, you know, it exists outside of the normal, you know, everyday stuff. It's hanging up everything. So I'm kind of hoping that we can make that happen and get it done in a timely fashion. Well, we still care about it, right? And you know, the other part of it, God, it would shut. Well, I don't know. This is probably a big wish, but maybe it would shut these guys up on the Social Security, Medicare thing, and all that. I don't know how many times they can tell everybody that.
Well, the Democrats like to lie. They love to lie. I mean, it's amazing. So you can't. Here's the thing. They're going to accuse you of doing all these horrible things regardless.
So that's true.
Just do the best policy you can. This is what I say. I mean, I, you know, when the Senate earlier in the year was trying to do this strategy, doing two different bills, and they said we're going to do border and defense, and then we're going to do tax later in the year, they actually did a budget that had zero tax provisions at all, and it ended up going nowhere because the House didn't take it up. But they did a budget with literally zero tax provisions of any kind, and yet every Democrat speech about it was this tax cuts for billionaires.
Yeah.
It literally did not have a tax instruction in the budget.
Right.
And they used the talking point anyway.
Right. Well, and the words Social Security aren't in there. You know,
they just say what they're going to say. It doesn't matter. They don't care whether it has any basis in reality. And so if that's the kind of opponents that you're dealing with, do not let them affect you.
Right.
Do not let them affect you or prevent you from doing the best bill you can do. That's what I've been telling these guys.
Yeah, exactly. And as a, you know, for the public, I mean, demand receipts. You know, when these guys tell you over and over and over that they're cutting something and it never happens, you know, we used to say, you know, crying wolf, right, when we were kids. Is that an outdated expression? Is there a new one? Because that's...
Yeah, you know, one of the things that drives me nuts is, when they did a version of this bill that had a bunch of Medicaid reforms in it, which, as I said, they basically backed off of at this point, Medicaid spending still went up every single year. It just didn't go up as much if the Democrats wanted it to. And yet, with it going up every single year, they say, oh, vicious cuts, most severe cuts. You're like, what are you talking about?
You're high again.
Yeah. Incredible.
Phil Kirpin, we have talked fast, but not fast enough. We have to go now.
All right. We
can't wait to see you again on our airwaves. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Down to Gonky Park, listening to the wind of change.